You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you very much. My name is Mwangi Kimenyi. I'm a senior fellow and director of the African Growth Initiative. I would like to welcome you to the Brookings Institution and to thank you for braving the weather. Ordinarily, in New England, where I came from, this would not be considered a bad weather day, but in Washington, we are worried when you get even an inch of snow. Thank you very much. We have a very distinguished panel of speakers today and a very important topic. As you may know, the fourth UN conference on the least developed countries will be held in May in Istanbul, Turkey. And this conference on the least developed countries is concerned about the many challenges facing these countries. There are 49 of them, and one of the reasons why us at the African Growth Initiative are very interested in this forum is that 33 of those are from sub-Saharan Africa. So when we talk about the least developed countries, in a way it's a stroke, sub-Saharan African countries. Actually, if you remove the countries going through the revolution in the north, you find that most of sub-Saharan Africa is actually part of these countries that we are talking about. But the story or the concern about these least developed countries is not, we don't have a very good story to tell. The first conference was held in 1981, and since then, only two countries have actually graduated from that category of countries. We economists tend to think about this being trapped, of the poverty traps. And it looks like these countries have not been able to break away. There's been progress, but generally they still remained very limited progress. And this forum, then, is part of consultations leading to the conference that will be held in May. One of these forums has already taken place in Brussels. There will be another one in Japan and another one in Korea. So today, the forum provides an opportunity for us to discuss progress made so far and how developed countries, and especially the United States, since we are here, can contribute to the realization of the development aspirations of this group of countries. The deliberations are an important input, therefore, into the fourth UN conference. So we would like to get as much information from this and comments on how we move to the fourth, to the conference in Istanbul. At this point, I would like also to say that our Vice President, Kamau Davis, who is obviously quite involved in this conference, would have liked very much to be a participant here, but he's away, and he sends his wishes to the participants. Brookings and the African Growth Initiative is pleased to collaborate with the Center of Concern in organizing this conference. Now, the way we proceed is I will introduce all the participants, and then they will have about 7 minutes each to comment, to give the highlights, and then we open this to the floor for your contribution and comments and questions. I'd like to briefly introduce the first speaker, Mr. Sheikh Sid Diarra, who is a UN Undersecretary General and Special Advisor on Africa and High Representative for the Least Developed Countries, Landlocked Developing Countries, and Small Island Developing States. I can imagine that if you are representative for all these countries, I think all what you see is a lot of problems there. So, but it's good to have you, and we look forward to listening to you. Next will be Dr. Ajahn Kirki, who is the Executive Director of LDC Watch, which is a civil society organization, and he will be the next to comment. Then we are very pleased to have Steve Ladret, who is the chief economist for the U.S. Agency for International Development. He has been a senior advisor for development for the Secretary of State, and not long before was actually one of our colleagues across the street at the as a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. Finally, we have our own Chuck, Lawrence Chandy, who is a fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program, and he focuses his research on developing countries and aid effectiveness. So we have a real distinguished panel, and what we do now is ask Mr. Diarra to start with the comments from the chair, and then we go on to Dr. Kark and so on, and then we open to questions. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kemeni, for this introduction. Distinguished participants, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me a great pleasure to engage with so many thinkers at one of the oldest and most respected think tank in the United States. Firstly, I would like to thank Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, Interaction and Center of Concern for co-organizing this timely event. This event provides us an opportunity to further explore the impact of the global policies on the fate of the poorest countries of the international community. It also gives me an opportunity to extend my sincere appreciation to all of you for challenging the weather and being here today. I'm sure that the LDC agenda would be enriched by your contribution to the discussions. Mr. Kemeni mentioned Mr. Kamal Dervish, one of the vice president of the Brookings Institution. Kamal Dervish happened to be one of the eminent persons that had been appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations to be part of eight others of his peer, including Mr. Wolfensohn, to contribute not only substantively to the preparation of the fourth United Nations Conference on the Least Developed Countries that will take place in Istanbul from the 9th to the 13th of May this year, but also they contribute with the stature and the renown to the overall advocacy at the global level in support of this conference. Allow me, this has been said, to briefly provide you a stage for this discussion this morning. The least developed countries is a United Nations defined category of low-income countries, all of which face severe structural constraints to economic growth and development. The group that was 49 until last December, one new country have graduated, which is Maldives, is currently 48. 33 of members of the group are in Africa. One is Haiti, and 14 more are in Asia and Pacific region, including five small islands of the Pacific region. And they represent the world's poorest nations. Many of these countries rank among the lowest on the Human Development Index. Chronic poverty, troubling maternal and child mortality rate, and staggering unemployment of the youth, particularly, figures are just some of the silent features of this group of countries. But this having been said, I should at the same time mention that the picture is not entirely gloomy. Over the last past 10 years, we have witnessed some encouraging improvement among the least developed countries, in part due to their own effort but also as a result of the concerted assistance from the development partners. In the context, international context of development aid, the United States continues to play a pivotal role in support of the least developed countries and has demonstrated its commitment politically and in concrete terms. At the United Nations MDG Summit last September, President Barack Obama reaffirmed increased assistance of the United States to the least developed countries. In addition, the United States has on several occasions articulated its full support to the least developed countries as a critical part of the United Nations overall development agenda. It is noteworthy that in 2009, the United States disbursed $8.1 billion in official development assistance to the least developed countries, which represents 22% of the total of $37 billion allocated in the form of ODA by OECD DAC 23 members. A number of food insecure least developed countries have also benefited the U.S. food security programs, and just this year, the United States announced that it will expand its $3.5 billion Feed for the Future program, an initiative that aims at to reach out to the global community to reduce poverty and hunger. On the economic front, the United States has expanded the scope of its generalized system of preferences to least developed countries since 1997 and has also carried out a duty-free, quota-free preferential treatment to several LDCs. At the same time, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, known under the acronym of AGOA, has contributed to enhanced trade with sub-Saharan Africa. AGOA has not only expanded U.S. trade and investment with sub-Saharan Africa, but has also stimulated regional economic growth and has effectively helped to facilitate the region's integration into global economy. Trade under AGOA totaled for $33.1 billion in 2010, a 57% increase from the same period in 2009. The United Nations is also encouraged by the current administration's recent pledge to seek a $4 billion contribution to the Global Fund to fight HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria from 2011 to 2013. Ladies and gentlemen, with this continued commitment from the United States and deepening partnership with other development partners, the least developed countries themselves have undertaken significant policy steps towards strengthening their national economies and mobilizing domestic financial resources for development. An increasing number of the least developed countries embrace good governance, and across the group of 48 countries, elections are the norm rather than the exception. Indeed, these are encouraging signs of progress which should be built upon, but this should not mask the reality. A relatively low human capital coupled with severe productive capacity constraint often leaves these countries in an extreme weak and vulnerable state. They are particularly susceptible to internal as well as external shocks, whether it be political uncertainties or recent financial crisis. What happens on Wall Street is invariably felt in Kabul, Lilongwe, and Dhaka, Bangladesh. In very real terms, the 2008-2009 crisis has meant that many of these countries have now to confront a decline in ODA, official development assistance, in foreign direct investment, and a dramatic reduction of foreign earnings for these countries as a result of commodity prices volatility. The impact of this far-reaching and enduring as much as of assistance was channeled to much-needed social economic programs in these countries. During the last decade, debt relief through the HIPIC initiatives since 2005 and the Multilateral Debt Relief Initiative have been effective in reducing the debt burden of LDCs. As of July 2010, 23 least developed countries are post-completion point countries out of 31 eligible to benefit the HIPIC or MDRI. Recent bilateral debt write-off and debt buyback operation have been also very important. Nevertheless, as of late 2010, 20 least developed countries were in the situation of debt distress or high risk of debt distress, and 5 of them are non-HIPIC. The financial crisis and debt incurred to ride over the crisis has caused by debt burden to rise. There is now a very real threat of reversal in some of the gain already achieved. Ladies and gentlemen, we now found ourselves on the eve of the 4th United Nations Conference on the Least Developed Countries. Since 1971, the world has gathered at 3 such global meetings, as it's been mentioned, to discuss the most effective ways to assisting the poorest among us. There has been gains, but ultimately there remained much to be done for improvement. Since the 3rd United Nations Conference held in 2001, just 3 countries have graduated from the category: Botswana, Cape Verde, and Maldives in 2011. 10 years have passed since the 3rd conference, and we held in Brussels. And in that time, the world has changed considerably. New and emerging challenges are felt not only by the least developed countries, but ripple across the globe. As a result of prevailing economic circumstances, many traditional donors are reluctant to recommit themselves to the new program of action to be adopted in Istanbul next May. Indeed, the recent recession has meant that many of us have to reevaluate our priorities, but I believe that it remains critical that development partners honour their commitment to the LDCs to provide 0.15 to 0.20% of their gross national income to the official development assistance to LDCs. On top of this, I believe that there is much scope for leading economies like the United States to further explore proposal and initiative on innovative sources of financing for development. One of such ideas that has gained traction is the Robin Hood tax, which advocate for international currency transaction levy, which at 5% per $1,000 could raise between $20 and $25 billion per annum for the least developed countries. Beside the traditional development program that focus on assistance to LDCs, I would urge donors towards a greater shift of extending trade preferences and global market access to LDCs. All development partners should accord full duty-free and quota-free market access to all products from the least developed countries. Needless to say, these schemes should be stable and predictable. It is widely recognized that special treatment and preferential access should be extended to all sectors of export from the least developed countries. The EU has drawn attention to aid for trade scheme for the least developed countries, and it is therefore advisable to scale up such a strategy to ensure support to trade-related infrastructure and building of export supply capacity. In a nutshell, the least developed countries themselves have appealed to development partners for tangible assistance in the following priority areas: productive capacity development, infrastructure and energy development, support to agriculture, information communication technology transfer, as well as assistance with their adaptation to climate change. These priority areas will be the focus of the upcoming 4th United Nations Conference to be held in Istanbul. The conference will provide a unique and inclusive platform for government, parliamentarians, the private sector, civil society and international organizations from around the world to negotiate and explore the full potential of partnerships for meaningful development and prosperity in the world's poorest countries. I should also highlight that a special intellectual forum dedicated to academics, policymakers, and thinkers will also feature as a key element of the civil society track in Istanbul. And I would like to extend an invitation to you all to participate in the conference. I look forward to listening to your ideas so that Istanbul outcome brings us a step closer to the global prosperity for all. I thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I go now to Dr.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, Excellencies, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, first and foremost, I would like to thank the Africa Initiative at Brookings, Interaction and Center of Concern for organizing this very important event pertaining to the LDC, that 48 most poorest and vulnerable block of countries in terms of today's development challenge, and I would like to call it development emergency. Moreover, this discussion is most timely considering the soon approaching 4th UN Conference on Least Developed Countries, scheduled on 9 to 13 May 2011 in Istanbul in Turkey. The LDC 4 in May is another historical opportunity for us all to adopt a new program of action for LDC for the upcoming decade. And with you, we share a collective challenge. How do we make this conference different, both qualitatively and quantitatively, from the last conference? In fact, all past three conferences. How do we succeed in witnessing a decade of reversing the growth in number of LDCs from 48, with at least half of the number of LDC graduating in next decade? Ladies and gentlemen, LDC already plagued by inherent geographical and environmental constraints that exacerbate both poverty and vulnerability endemic in LDC. They are further being severely impacted by crises they have had no role in creating. Crisis of the financial system, food prices, energy, the climate system. These crises have intensified situation of conflict, violence, political instability, and human rights violence. These are the characteristics of most LDCs. The world has changed, and so must the approaches that we use to address the challenges faced by LDCs. This is only possible with a genuine partnership between the LDC and the strategic development partner and court on clearly defined, result-oriented support measures and mechanism for the coming decade. We must aim to close the gaps, to achieve international convergence, and to give hope to more than 850 million people living in the LDCs. And for this, we need bold and decisive political leadership from the LDCs and the rest of the international community to come up with a new and ambitious LDC agenda in Istanbul. Ladies and gentlemen, the new alternative development pathway for the LDC must be departure from the business as usual approach, embracing the following specific and immediate actions. Debt cancellation. LDCs are in perpetual debt crisis, spending $6.03 billion every year on debt servicing, which is exacerbated by factors beyond their control. Many LDCs spend more money on debt servicing than on essential services like healthcare, drinking water, and energy. This therefore calls for total, immediate, and unconditional cancellation of multilateral and bilateral LDC debt. the resources thus mobilized going instead for provision of essential services and social protection to LDC citizens. The other issue is food crisis. 1/6 of the world population, most of them in LDC, suffer from chronic hunger, which is a humanitarian crisis on a daily basis. Only the principle of food sovereignty that is being advocated by the small farmers movement in LDC can effectively address this humanitarian problem. Food sovereignty focuses on food for people, values, food providers, localized food system, puts control locally, build local skill and knowledge, and preserve nature with agroecological production, urgent structural changes, including comprehensive agrarian reform, support services for agriculture food production, ending speculation on staple food, the break of food trade cartel, and most importantly, delivering on the climate change commitment to reduce the risk of environmental degradation are imperative to reduce the food crisis in LDCs. The other issue I would like to highlight is trade. LDC suffers the brunt of the impact of unfair trade agreement in their dominant free market paradigm. Despite commitment to provide duty-free and quota-free market access for LDC, tariffs are still levied on LDC export, such as textile and agriculture product. Moreover, the issues of non-tariff barriers and stringent rules of origin requirements further hamper market access for LDC export. LDC definitely need fair trade as an engine of growth. The other issue I would like to highlight is MDG. Achieving the MDG in LDC is a global responsibility bound by genuine shared commitment. Clearly, many of the goals and targets of Millennium Declaration will not be achieved in LDC by 2015. We are therefore spreading the campaign No MDG Without LDC, focusing on mobilizing the political will of stakeholders, as LDCs are often a forgotten cause. LDC 4 conference must support the development of mechanisms for a predictable and assured flow of development assistance for LDC that is grounded in evidence, transparency, and results. It must also make provision for financial transaction tax, which, as explained by Ambassador Diarra earlier, equitable tax on fossil fuel and greenhouse gas emission, and an end to tax diversion, avoidance, and capital flight. It must serve and reinforce the principle of development effectiveness to be truly effective. The principle of country ownership, predictability, transparency, and accountability are key, as well as the responsibility to meeting the commitment of 0.20% of GNI to LDCs. Crisis mitigation and resilience. Crisis response and stimulus packages, especially for the LDC, must be priority commitment in the form of grants, not loan. In the past 2 years, we saw how the US and European government moved trillions of dollars in rescue packages for private banks and corporations. The LDC suffers disproportionately from economic and ecological shock that include natural disaster, economic downturn, fluctuation in price of food and energy, and conflict, which almost invariably causes growth deceleration. A special mechanism for mitigating shocks is critical for protecting hard-won development gain while building their resilience to withstand future shocks and crises. Many LDCs are being devastated by the impact of climate change. Without immediate action to reduce greenhouse gas emission, this impact threatens to reverse any development gain over the past 50 years and cause suffering on a massive scale. Educate additional and equitable climate finance is imperative as part of the historic responsibility of developed nations for greenhouse gas emission that have caused climate change and to which LDC are no party. The new Green Climate Fund must include dedicated funding for adaptation in LDC. Assistance is also urgently required. LDC to be able to protect their people and infrastructure and to adapt to climate change. A dedicated mechanism must be agreed in Istanbul that would kick-start the immediate follow-up of implementation of Istanbul Program of Action, drawing on the momentum of LDC 4, A global campaign on LDCs that has been missing until now is the need for the hour. This campaign should be multifaceted in terms of LDC-specific advocacy, capacity building, research, and resource generation that will contribute towards a sustainable focus and attention towards pro-poor development in LDC. Ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, the new LDC program of action for the coming decade adopted in Istanbul must articulate a radical new concrete agenda aiming towards the graduation of at least half of the current number of LDC. This decade must indeed be different, marking a decrease in the number of LDCs, thus redressing our past failures and advancing towards the new vision of old without LDC. In this context, we commend the active role of the US in the current intergovernmental negotiation vis-à-vis the outcome of LDC-4. We urge the US to further demonstrate its leadership in the global partnership for development by defending the interest of the most vulnerable and marginalized group of countries on the development radar today. We urge for a political leadership upholding human security and human dignity for all, placing people at the center of development. 2011 marks the 25th anniversary of right to development, and we would like to see LDC-4 pave the concrete path to development for the LDC. As we are mobilizing political participation of all stakeholders towards LDC-4 on behalf of LDC Civil Society Steering Committee, I would also like to request you and your networks and allies to join us in Istanbul in support and solidarity for the LDC. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Dr. Steve Radrit, please.
Good morning. Thanks to everyone for being here this morning. I'm really happy to be here with you today to talk about the issues on LDCs. More broadly than LDCs and development more generally, this is a really important time of change for the United States. Starting last year, we began to implement a number of changes which are really in fundamental ways changing how we're approaching developing countries around the world. Most importantly, in September, as many of you know, President Obama issued the first presidential policy directive on development. This is the first time in the history of the United States that a president has issued a formal policy on development to say why is it in the interest of the United States to engage with developing countries, how we're going to do it, and how we can do it better. It's never happened before. Following that, of course, the president appeared at the MDG summit, which I think is a pretty loud statement as to the importance of developing countries for the president himself. In December, Secretary Clinton released the first quadrennial development and diplomacy review, or rather awkwardly named, as only government bureaucrats could name something, the QDDR. Even with its awkward name, a pretty important step forward, where for over a year, the State Department and USAID engaged in a very deep review of what we do and how we do it and how we can do better. Again, had never been done before. And we refer to it as the quadrennial development and diplomacy review with the idea that this will be the first of many that will happen with each every 4 years with each administration. So there's been a lot of deep thinking about how we can engage and how we can do things quite differently. At USAID, we've taken this forward with a new set of reforms called USAID Forward, which are quite fundamental and deep reforms about how we are trying to be more effective in our work in developing countries. Throughout all of this, it's become very clear, and it's now a matter of policy at the presidential level, that the U.S. believes that development of the poorest countries around the world is not just important, but is a moral and strategic and economic imperative for the United States. That's now embedded in policy. So there's a number of things that I think I just want to highlight quickly in terms of what this means in practice. First, we have a commitment to better focus our resources, both across countries and within countries, instead of spreading ourselves too thin across too many countries where a lot of our investments aren't doing particularly well, but also within countries where we tend to do too many things And one part of the United States government doesn't always know what the other part of the United States government is doing. So we're much more committed to focusing our investments and working together within the interagency in a much better way. We're focusing more on economic growth, broad-based, sustainable economic growth, as we know that growth, that broad-based growth is the key engine for reducing poverty over time. That these are manifesting themselves in the programs that were mentioned earlier, most particularly Feed the Future, our new food security program, where the President has pledged $3.5 billion over 3 years as a start to really refocus on food security and agricultural and nutrition investments. I just got back from Tanzania and Ghana, where as part of a group involving OPIC, USAID, the State Department, and the Millennium Challenge Corporation and others, where we are working together to design an investment project under the strategies that the countries themselves have laid out in a strong participatory process, that we are working to invest in their programs to really jumpstart agricultural development and nutrition to enhance food security. So we're actually not just talking about this, we are doing it already. In addition to the focused investments in these areas, we're really changing our approach and how we engage, not just what we do, but how we do it. And most important, a strong thread through the President's policy directive and through the QDDR is on partnership and really working closely with our partners in governments and outside of governments in the countries with whom we work, partners with other donors, but most importantly, working in a much closer relationship with the people and the governments of our partner countries. And again, we're not just talking about this, but we're doing this in our health initiative and our food security initiative and other places where instead of coming in and deciding what we're going to do, we ask what the highest priorities will be. I'm sending a team back out to Tanzania and Ghana next week, which will work as half of a team along with technical people from the Tanzanian government team and the Ghanaian team to work on jointly coming up with a strategy for how we can better invest in economic growth to support broad-based growth. We haven't in the past sent our teams in to work jointly with government teams, so it's a whole new way of engaging with our countries, with the countries that we work with. Related to the partnership, we have a strong new commitment to transparency. We've talked a lot about it in the past, but again, this is not just talk, we're doing it. In December, we put up a new website called foreignassistance.gov, which is our aid dashboard. And for the first time, you can go to one place and a really nice website, and you can see the funding that has been committed and delivered over the last 5 years to every country that the United States has worked with. You can find the State Department and USAID funding is already up there for the last 5 years. It's there now in one place. People have complained for years. I used to complain when I was outside of government. It's impossible to get the data. But now it is possible to get at least some of the data. It's a first step. It's a great website. Take a look at it. You can download lots of data over 5 years for lots of countries. We're going to add to it with data from the Millennium Challenge Corporation and other U.S. government programs. And over time, we're going to add new commitments, contracts, and statements about what we're going to do going forward. So we have a new commitment to transparency, and again, not just talk, but actual action where you can see what we're doing. We have a new, a stronger, much stronger commitment to embedding issues around women and girls in all of our programs, starting obviously with the President's commitment, Secretary Clinton's commitment, Administrator Shaw's commitment, and everyone else. And we're not just talking about this as a separate silo for something on women in development or new programs that are specifically geared, that are siloed and separate from what we're doing, but rather deeply embedding issues of focus on women and girls in our agricultural programs, in our nutrition programs, in our health programs, and really recognizing and driving the issue that providing new opportunities for women and girls is central to accelerating growth and poverty reduction. So we're putting that into action now. And we're also, instead of talking about results, actually doing more and more on improving our focus on mutual accountability and driving what we do not just about the money we deliver, but the results that are delivered from this. So USAID just last week, 2 weeks ago, issued a new evaluation policy That sounds pretty boring, but it's actually worth a read. It's only about 10 pages long, and it is a very clear statement of policy about how we will evaluate programs under different circumstances and the different techniques that we will use to get a much better handle on what we are achieving and holding ourselves more accountable for achieving results. So it's really a new day, and there's a lot of new energy over at USAID and at the State Department more broadly in terms of how we deliver assistance. You will also see that we have strongly embraced the aid effectiveness principles as laid out first as the Paris principles and then in the Accra Agenda for Action. Instead of just kind of lukewarm saying, yes, we agree, they are central to the QDDR. They are stated there in terms of a new commitment to these aid effectiveness principles. And believe me, I was in the midst of writing that chapter. It would have been very easy for people to just say, nah, we're just going to kind of not mention that stuff because we don't have to. But there wasn't that at all. It was absolutely. We are embracing these principles as the best way that we can make our aid programs more effective. But beyond aid, we're also taking measures to support other things. There's been lots of talk about trade, but also I want to highlight our newfound new instruments on natural resource flows. We have a strong commitment to the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which many of you are familiar with, and working with countries to build their capacity to better manage and report on the flows that they receive from natural resource investments. But it's not just what the recipient countries themselves do. We are committed as a country where a lot of these flows stem from. And so we've recently passed, the Congress has just recently passed legislation, the Frank Dodd Bill, which is a path-breaking new set of legislation which will require companies registered with the SEC to disclose payments related to natural resources. This is a huge step forward, and that we are encouraging other countries to follow this example to be much more transparent about natural resource flow. So there's a lot of good things happening. With respect to the LDCs, as we work towards the LDC4 conference, we are in May. Our approach will continue to be guided by these commitments and the broader commitments that we made in September 2010 MDG high-level meeting and the 2008 Doha Declaration on Financing for Development and in 2002 Monterey Conference. So we've got a big set of commitments that we are absolutely committed to and really following through and making sure that those are fully implemented as our starting point. In terms of our foreign assistance to the LDCs, as was mentioned, in 2009, funding had gone up to over $8 billion, but our preliminary figures for 2010, these are preliminary, it appears that it will be close to $11 billion. This is in comparison to 2006 when it was $4 billion. So we've gone from $4 billion to nearly $11 billion in 4 years. It's an increase of 2.5 times in just 4 years. So there is a significant increase in funding for these countries. And they preliminarily looks like there's increases in almost all of the countries. There's bigger increases in some, smaller increases in others, but by a preliminary look, it looked like there were increases over this time in all but five of the LDCs. So it's pretty widely spread and more than doubling in just four years. The administration is committed in doing what it can to further increase that funding. We have our request for 2011 and 2012, and despite the very difficult budget climate, the president has requested further increases in foreign assistance broadly and for the LDCs as well. You know as much as I do about where that will ultimately go forward. We're in negotiations with Congress, but the fact that the president has continued to ask for increases in this area while other places are being cut, shows his commitment and the administration's commitment more generally to trying to protect these funds and trying to get some increases despite the austerity that we face more broadly. For the LDCs, the story over the last few years is mixed but more positive than it has been in the past, as we heard more recently. It's true that most of the LDCs will not achieve the MDGs. Part of that, however, is because of the difficulties during the 1990s, because the benchmark for the MDGs was in 1990, and the 1990s were a difficult time for many of these countries. The good news is that in the last decade, many countries have begun to turn around and are, at least over the last 10 years, on a pace that's more consistent with achieving the MDGs had they started in 2000 or 2002. The growth rates for the LDCs as a whole have been over 5% over the last several years. Per capita basis, over 3%. This is well above the world average growth rate, which has been about 2% per capita. With these countries, it's been about 3% per capita. So they're beginning to get economic growth over sustained periods of time. We're beginning to see that show up in poverty reduction in many, not all, of the countries. But we're beginning in the last few years to see signs that the growth is spreading and is beginning to pay off. Not only is there more progress economically, many of the LDCs have become democracies. If you look at the list of the LDCs and think about where they were 20 years ago, very, very few, if any, would have been counted as democracies. Botswana, which used to be but now has graduated, other than that, would have been hard to actually identify democracy among the LDCs 20, 25 years ago before the end of the Cold War and the end of apartheid. Now that has changed quite dramatically, and many of them, Tanzania, Mali, Liberia, and many others are now vibrant democracies. And some of them, like Liberia, torn apart by war just a few short years ago and has now dramatically turned things around. So, and with that democracy, not just elections, we're seeing more transparency, we're seeing more accountability, we're seeing parliaments get more involved, we're seeing a more open press, more human rights being observed in many of the LDCs, but not all of them. In many ways, actually, politically, there's a bit of a split where some countries are moving towards much more accountable and credible governments. Others are being left behind. And so it's a little harder to make generalizations about where those countries are going politically because of the diversity. I'll give a little plug for a book that I've just written called Emerging Africa, which talks specifically about these kinds of patterns in Africa, not the LDCs as a whole, but in African countries, and really makes the point that to understand trends in sub-Saharan Africa over the last 15 years, you have to recognize big divergences in what is happening both economically and politically. So one size does not fit all with the LDCs, and we have to think very hard on the approaches that I just laid out with USAID, where partnership makes sense and where, frankly, it makes less sense. Because the real responsibility, the strongest responsibility, of course, for development lies with the people and the governments of the countries themselves. As outsiders, we have to recognize the limits of what we can do. But we stand ready to support the people and the governments that are ready to move in the right direction and ready to have strong partnerships committed to economic growth and to poverty reduction. Some are likely to be more successful than others, but we stand ready to work with those in partnership that are committed to do so. So we are not just remaining committed to these countries. We have strengthened our commitment, both financially in terms of the financing that we provide, but also in how we are working in a much more transparent way in a much stronger partnership so that we can hopefully continue to see continued progress in growth, poverty reduction, and development in these countries going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll ask Chuck to try to keep within 7 minutes so that we can have a discussion. So, thank
my
you.
My problem with being last. Everyone else takes 15 minutes. You get stuck with seven.
I actually practiced this with my wife yesterday, and it's only about 7.5 minutes. So I think
we'll
I'm
give
gonna
you that.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up on some of the themes, especially the ones which Stephen was talking about. I think to understand the changing fortunes of least developed countries, it helps to first consider the broader context and the trends that have shaped the global economy over the last decade. That's the decade which the English fondly refer to as the noughties, which I think is a great name. There are two major trends, as I see it, which help to characterize the last decade, especially for the developing world. The first one is that it's been an absolute bumper decade for growth in the developing world. Let me give you some figures for that. For six of the last 7 years, the developing world as a whole has grown at above 6 percentage points a year. The last time the developing world as a whole grew at more than 6 percentage points in 1 year before the last decade was in the 1970s. So it's been a phenomenally strong period of growth for the developing world as a whole. And there's no doubt that growth has translated into poverty reduction. We don't have official data on it yet, but it looks almost certain that this has been a great period for poverty reduction. I co-wrote a paper last month, this is my plug, with my colleague Jeff Gertz, who's in the audience, called Poverty in Numbers. Look it up. And We try to update the official global poverty estimates because there are no official aggregate estimates beyond 2005. And we believe that just from 2005 to 2010, almost 500 million people have been brought out of poverty. And this is unprecedented. And it also means that the first Millennium Development Goal target, MDG 1A, to half the rate of global poverty from 1990 to 2015 has probably been achieved at some point in the last few years. Now, behind this phenomenal story of aggregates, of growth and poverty reduction, is a country story of divergence. There are countries who are leading this trend, countries who are being carried along with it, and countries who are being left behind. And this divergence is probably captured best by looking at the changing composition of global poverty today. There are two major trends happening. One, as people are being lifted out of poverty, just focuses on those who remain in poverty. Number one, poverty is increasingly being concentrated in Africa. And number two, poverty is increasingly being concentrated in fragile states. Here are some figures. In 2005, 28% of the global poor lived in Africa. We estimate today that it's around 45% of the global poor. By 2015, on our forecast, we believe it will be around 60%. For fragile states, in 2005, around 20% of the world's poor lived in fragile states. Today, it's around 40%. And by 2014, it will be more than half of the world's poor. So this is my first major trend. The second major trend is that we've entered this period where there are more crises taking place. We appear to have entered this sort of more volatile period. We've already heard discussion of the food crisis, the fuel crisis, the financial crisis, and then kind of the mother of all crises, which is sort of looming on the horizon, is the climate crisis. This is all just in the last 4 years or so. And perhaps the interesting thing about these crises is that they don't hit countries indiscriminately. They don't just hit everyone. They hit certain countries, those who are most vulnerable, those who are most exposed. And so they're really testing developing countries in terms of their capacity to respond to crises, to shelter their economies and their populations. And this has led to this new focus on this topic of, on this issue of resilience, how to make countries resilient, which is really about trying to help countries develop the assets and the institutions to protect themselves. So those are the two big trends which I see, which have shaped these last few years. The question is, how does this relate to least developed countries? Well, the answer is that it completely relates to least developed countries, because the whole notion of least developed countries is concerned with these exact issues. Which countries are being left behind, and which ones are most at risk to shocks? That's exactly what the indicators which the UN uses to classify least developed countries are concerned with. So then how are the least developed countries doing? How have they fared in this last decade, and how have they managed to traverse these shocks of the last few years? Now, on the growth front, there is some positive news, and Steve mentioned it. Around a third of the least developed countries, that's 18 of them I calculated on the weekend, have managed to sustain growth rates in per capita income of above 3.5 percentage points a year over the last decade. Why the arbitrary level 3.5 percentage points? Well, 3.5%, it turns out, is a magic number, because due to the sort of magic of compound effects, if you maintain growth rates of 3.5% and per capita growth for a decade, you double income levels every 20 years, which is a nice proxy for the length of a generation. So if these countries, these 18 countries, one third of the least developed countries, manage to sustain those rates, then they're going to be going through an incredible transformation over the coming period. So, this is a great story for this one third of the least developed countries who I'm talking about. The usual suspects, Rwanda, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, Cambodia, Laos. So for those third of the least developed countries, they're doing very well. We're seeing a very similar story, unsurprisingly, on the poverty side. According to our estimates, there are 14 least developed countries who, just between 2005 and 2010, reduced their poverty rates by more than 10 percentage points, which is a phenomenal performance. The trouble is that for every one of those 14 countries, there's another least developed country whose poverty rates have increased over those 5 years. So like Steve mentioned, there is this divergence going on within the least developed country group. For crises, I think the story on crises is quite complicated in terms of how the least developed countries have fared. Based on the analysis which we've done at Brookings, we believe the least developed countries actually fared fairly well over the financial crisis, contrary to all expectations, including my own. I wrote a blog piece, a few weeks into the crisis, saying, you know, this is going to hit the poorest countries the worst. You know, everyone has to get ready for this. We need a global response. It turns out I was probably wrong. I mean, there's no doubt that there are some countries who were hit, but on the whole, the least developed countries fared very well. There's great data to back this up. I won't bore you with the numbers. But what I can tell you is that for the better managed least developed countries, those countries who've had improved macro management over the macroeconomic management over the last few years, these countries are able to put in place quite effective policy responses to the crisis. We saw Angola draw down on its reserves. We saw Tanzania increase its money supply. We saw a fiscal stimulus, which looked a lot like the one in the US and Uganda. We had a big stimulus with spending on agriculture and investment. So on a financial crisis side, at least, it seems the least developed countries fared fairly well. On the food crisis and the fuel crisis, it seems to me that the least developed countries on the whole were very much at the mercy of the markets. So while some did okay, you know, Angola and Sudan probably enjoyed the fuel crisis because of the increased fuel prices and the improved terms of trade, others were absolutely at the mercy of the markets. So let me just finish with two brief recommendations for what we might do to help least developed countries over the next decade. Both of these ideas are very much focused on this issue of resilience, on how we can improve the resilience of least developed countries. Here's my first one. We need to reduce the volatility of aid. It turns out, according to my colleague Homi Karas at Brookings, that aid is very volatile, and the volatility of aid creates incredibly pernicious effects on recipients. I'm not talking here about the concerns in the US here about, you know, about the budget squeeze and how that affects aid flows. I'm talking about fickle programming decisions, where one year that you decide to give aid to a country, the next year you withdraw it, the next year it comes back. I think donors need to move beyond this mindset where they think of aid as this carrot which you can use to try and induce policy reform in recipient countries, and then occasionally take the carrot and hit the country over the head with it. It's not a very effective tool for bringing about policy change, for putting pressure on governments. It does hurt the people in those countries. I don't think it hurts the governments very much. Just in the last few weeks, we've heard, you know, actually on the weekend, there were reports that that President Obama, in his discussions with Mahmoud Abbas, threatened to withdraw aid from the Palestinian authorities. I wish that donor countries would stop doing this, if that report's true. I do believe that aid should be about a long-term commitment with donors to recipients, and that we should stop this stop-start process with aid. Now, the third high-level forum on aid effectiveness 3 years ago in Accra, there was a really useful discussion about the predictability of aid. But I'm talking here not just about predictability. I'm not talking about telling a country next year we're cutting our aid, the next year we're going to increase it. That's entirely predictable. I'm talking about volatility. And I hope that the high-level forum this year, which is taking place in Busan, in South Korea, that there will be a proper discussion about the cost of volatile aid. And it's something which might be brought up in Turkey. My second recommendation, it's my final point. This one is a little bit out there. It's about the feasibility of putting in place a global social safety net to help the poorest people in the world. Now, if I'd said this 5 years ago, you would all be justified in rolling around laughing on the floor for two reasons. Number one, you would have said, this is logistically impossible. Number two, you would have said, how on earth could we afford it? It seems to me that both these things might no longer be true due to what we now know over the last 5 years. In terms of the logistics, in the last few years, we've seen a lot of experimentation with putting in place cash transfer schemes in some of the most difficult places in the world, not just in benign places like in Latin America. I'm talking about places like Goma in East DRC. It seems we can put in place basic social safety nets even in the most difficult environments. On the cost side, two things have changed. Number one, there's less poverty in the world, so it would cost less to put. Simply the value of transfers would be considerably less than it would have been a few years ago. And secondly, the volume of aid has increased. So my colleague Jeff Gertz and I, we plugged the numbers. In 2005, it would cost $96 billion in transfers to bring every person who lives under $1.25 a day up to the $1.25 level. Not very much, but enough to provide them, you know, with the nutrition they need, the shelter and so forth. That would have been 80% of aid flows, of official aid flows in 2005. 2010, it would cost only $66 billion, which is half of all official aid flows. If you consider private flows as well, it's probably only a third of all aid. So what I'm asking is if there's anyone in the audience who has the sort of money which maybe Bill Gates has and wants to sort of try and beat what he did. This is the next big issue. I don't think we're going to see a global social safety net put in place overnight. I think it's likely to happen first in regions, then in countries, then in continents. But I do think it's starting to become something feasible which we should be talking about. I read yesterday that the UN has put out reports on exactly this issue where they're recommending something similar. To which I say bravo, but my colleague Jeff and I, we plugged the numbers first just a few weeks ago.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lawrence. And thank you very much, all the panelists. I don't want to attempt to summarize what has transpired so far, and I want to leave time so that we get comments. But we have heard about a lot of suggestions, including innovative approaches to aid, the issue of trade, duty-free access, quota-free, debt, the issues of debt, food security, climate change, and a lot of other issues, including the U.S. position, particularly what the United States government is doing with its new innovative approaches to dealing with development in a wholesome way. So what I would like to do at this point is open for comments and questions. But since I know that many of you do want to comment, please keep it short. I would like to take a couple of questions, and I don't think you need to specifically direct it to any particular person. We open it to the whole all the panelists. Keep in mind that one of the ideas is to input. It's an input to the coming conference in May. So suggestions would also be welcome, and also looking at, you know, are these programs realistic? And at this time, are we focusing more on aid? Are we focusing on reforms within the countries and so on? So please be very brief and specific. And we have questions. So we'll start with the gentleman right there. Why don't we? Yeah. Please be brief.
My name is Mark Harrison. I work at the United Methodist Board of Church and Society. Dear Secretary Daira, could you tell Steve why there should be a currency transaction levy? And Steve, will you tell Daira why there should not be a currency transaction levy? And to Arjun, you are standing in a group of Americans. The unemployment rate is over 9%. This is the worst recession that this country has ever had since the Depression. And you're saying, well, let's open up the markets and duty-free, and what impact is that going to have on employment here? So you are talking to an American group of unemployed right now, not the people in this room.
Thank you very much for being brief. Okay, another one. Okay, right there. Brother, could you come in front and take them from here? The lady at the corner.
Hi, my name is Achen Odur. And if you're looking at the economic trends in Africa, a lot of the growth has also been attributed to more trade with African countries, between African countries and the BRICS. So how do you see US and the EU partnering with the BRICS to boost economic growth in sub-Saharan African countries? The other question that I had has to do with political volatility. I think part of it also contributes to aid volatility in the region. Some of these states are not actual states. So how do you deal with that issue of statehoodness and aid? And is it more aid that we need, or should we be focusing on security reform or institutional reform in some of these countries? Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, another one? Then, okay, so... the red light here, please.
Hello, I'm Rebecca Tan from the Protection Project in SAIS. I was wondering, This is specific to what Lawrence shared about the volatility of aid. How feasible do you think it is in this day and age to tie aid or promises of trade to political change? So, for example, in the case of the trade embargo in Burma, where it's not really having an effect, how feasible do you think it really is today, and whether there should be a reconsideration of, you know, the principles behind aid or the conditions that we attach to them?
One more before we get Dr. Suruma. Dr. Suruma is one of ours, a former Minister of Finance in Uganda, so he has dealt with this issue. So,
thank you very much, Simanje, for introducing me. On transparency, Mr. Radlett, I was glad to hear that USAID is becoming more transparent. My experience was that we didn't really know what USAID was doing in Uganda. But they were so big, we just left them alone. They would come in once in a while and tell us what they were planning to do, but our view was that they were not really transparent. I'm glad to hear that you're trying to make them more transparent, and I hope this will indeed be the trend. And also the teamwork, I think, is extremely important, that we are engaged and increase trust in what we are trying to do. Lawrence, I'm a bit worried. When one of my ministers in the Ministry of Finance attended a meeting in Zambia, I think, and came back with these ideas of cash transfers, I was not very happy about it. For the reason that you gave us, the volatility, for example. If it's coming and going, and one year it's coming and another year it doesn't come, and you made people dependent on it, I think it would be extremely dangerous. For the same reason that people here are not so warm on warfare, we wouldn't want to... I mean, it's clear that we would like to support starving people so that they have something to eat. Perhaps if there is a drought or something like this, it's understandable that we should assist. But I think if we have a policy of giving cash transfers and people know that money is coming, and it may, but then we find that sometimes it comes and sometimes it doesn't come, I can see some real dangers of this policy and would be worried about it in terms of incentives and dependency. We're trying to stop dependency, not increase dependency in aid. And finally, on the fragile states, I was glad to hear, I wasn't glad to hear, I think there was some indication of perhaps a reduction in fragility, I don't know, but you said something about where stability has increased, political stability, then probably a growth has improved as well. This is also my view. And I hope that capacity building, and particularly in Africa in elections, as you know, we're having a great deal of problems with elections in, for example, in Ivory Coast. And I think there is really a great deal of need for assisting in holding transparent and clear elections so that we know, people can know who has actually won elections. And then this could contribute to ending this fragility, which is a big problem for growth. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. I think I would like the panelists to respond very briefly so that we take another round. But I think for Steve, I would also like to mention that we hosted the Minister for Finance from Rwanda, and he said he didn't know how much money was coming from USAID. He couldn't explain what was coming in. So it's very good that you have that. And next time he comes, I think we would like him to visit you down there to see that. But why don't I start with...
Yes,
very briefly.
Thank you, sir, for your question. I'm going to be very brief. The technical feasibility of the levy is established. It's internationally accepted.
Many OECD members, including European Union members, I can name a few here, formally committed that they would adhere to that principle. It's about 0.05 cents for each dollar in a trillion, 2 to 3 trillion transactions per day. The advantage of that is that it will relieve the donor countries in terms of governmental contribution into official development assistance. Currently, it's mainly the government's budget that support the official development assistance. We're seeing more and more private foundations and NGOs pitching in, but the initial support, international support in terms of assistance, for development assistance, was mainly governmental. So this levy would mobilize, we have estimated, up to $42 billion new money, which will double the current level of $37 billion, that is. The only problem is a philosophical problem. Should we tax business to give it in support of the poorest? It's only that. But my practical approach is that, yes, if you do that, you empower the poorest to become potential consumers and potential producers so that they would make the business run again on the other end. So that's my only reply I can provide you with. We fully support this levy on financial transactions. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Have a minute, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. In fact, I understand your question, and it is we have observed that there is crisis in developed country as well. But we are raising this issue of fair trade in the context of development emergency that is taking place in the 48 UN-defined poorest countries of the world. And there are issues like trade deficit as well. These countries are...
All right. I think that's it. Well, the last one.
From this developed country, so that by allowing LDC product in this country, you can really maintain the fair deal with this country in terms of maintaining their balance of payment, and this can also play a role of engine of growth and also generate innovative sources of financing in social sector investment in these 48 UN-defined poorest countries.
Okay, thanks. Steve?
Thank you.
Yes, U.S. is on the currency.
On the currency transactions. I think the issue is really not so much about finding a new source of revenue as it is making the case of the importance to the United States about engaging with developing countries and making the case that we can do it effectively. We could think of a number of areas of things we could tax. We could have a financial transactions tax. We could have a wealth tax. We could have a death tax, an estate tax, not a death tax, sorry, an estate tax, I'm sorry. We could have a land transactions tax. We could have an airline a ticket levy. We can think of a number of ways to levy taxes. We collect in the United States $1.2 trillion in taxes. Probably not enough for a lot of the things that we want to do. So the issue is not finding such a clever way to tax. We could find a lot of different ways. It's a much broader issue about financial resources available and how to spend them. The United States has substantially increased its assistance to developing countries over the last 10 years. It was not because we found some new tax. It had nothing to do with that at all. What it had to do was building a coalition of people who understood the importance of these issues to the people of the United States and making the case that we could do it effectively. Going forward, if we're interested in continuing to increase the financial resources, that's the way that we need to continue to work. That's going to be harder because of the financial constraints that we face. But if Congress could find new ways that were painless to tax people that wouldn't have the implications that they worry about, they would go ahead and do it. I'm not sure they would spend it the first thing on development. But we've been very successful over the last decade by building the coalition of the importance and showing that we can be successful. That's the way forward. On the specifics on the financial transactions tax, there's a lot of evidence that while it might collect a lot of revenues if it could be done well, that the costs and the difficulties in actually collecting the tax are pretty significant. It's not such an easy thing to do. There would probably be a lot of folks trying to circumvent it, as with any tax. So it's not at all clear that it would actually collect that much revenue. But again, that's not really the issue. The issue is in making the case that this is the effective thing to do, and we're making a lot of progress on that. There was another question about the Sub-Saharan Africa and the BRICS. There has been a lot of investment into Sub-Saharan Africa by some of the BRICS and other countries, and it's in many ways it's a great thing that it's showing Sub-Saharan African countries becoming more integrated into the world economy and creating lots of new opportunities. There are some downsides to some of that stuff. We've got to be. This is where the issues around transparency are so important. That it's important that that stuff become very transparent and very open. In terms of the United States, the question was basically that the BRICS are really increasing their foreign direct investment much faster than the United States is, and that's true. And we're very conscious of that. And we are through many of the measures that I talked about, trying to change people's attitudes about countries in sub-Saharan Africa and least developed countries in general to make the case that things are beginning to turn around. And we're using in different ways around investment conferences and other kinds of ways to encourage private companies to take another look at the opportunities in many developing countries with some success. I just came back from Tanzania. I visited a flour mill where General Mills is doing some work with this little flour mill in Arusha that employs 28 people, and they've got a direct connection to General Mills of all places. So step by step, we're beginning to do that. I think it's a really big challenge. I think it's an excellent question. We're very conscious of it, and we're beginning to take steps now to see if we can encourage more issues there. Minister Schum, it's nice to see you again. And it wasn't really a question; it was a statement. And, you know, on transparency of USAID flows, and I'm with you. I've been outside of government for many years, and even as an American, I could never quite figure it out. So it's very complicated for a number of reasons, and it's not just USAID. One of our problems, one of our challenges, is that we have a number of U.S. government actors, the Department of Health and Human Services, USAID, State, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, Treasury, many others. So it's complicated because of the arrangements that we have here. But we are beginning to really take this seriously. And as I said, we are committed to moving forward not only to getting better data up in terms of what has been spent, but doing a much better job of being publicly transparent about the projects underway, the commitments that we have made, what we're trying to achieve, and making that much more public. So we're underway in trying to improve that.
Okay. Chuck, just talk about the global social safety net. Briefly.
The social safety net. That's all. So let me just say briefly on that I think, Dr. Sriam, I'm more of a believer than you are in the value of these social safety nets, but I defer to your judgment. The point I wanted to make was that these things are now feasible on a scale they might not have been before. But I do think you're right that any social safety net needs to be recipient owned. If the recipient country doesn't want it, they shouldn't have it. Two, it should be, you know, there should be long-term funding. And so, you know, you're exactly right on that. And three, we need to do proper evaluations to know whether it does create these sort of dependency effects you talk about. Can I just briefly say on the two volatility questions, the research which my colleague Homi Karas has done at Brookings suggests that around two-thirds of the cause of volatility is due to changing conditions in the recipient country. So you're exactly, you know, this is about the kind of governance challenge. So you're exactly right to bring those up. The other third are due to sort of fickle behavior, you know, just fickle sort of decision making by the donors. what I would like to see is in those two-thirds of the situations where the conditions change in the country, that rather than donors turning on and off the taps, that they change the modality of their aid. They adopt different approaches essentially to how they deliver their aid rather than affecting the flows themselves. I think that's it's easier said than done. But I think that there's a I think we could go a lot further on that. And there are other people now talking about that a lot. I think Paul Collier has been talking about that a lot this year. I'll stop.
I think I can take. They are coming up. So I can take start here, Brandon, maybe very briefly, maybe a couple of them, and we conclude very briefly. So thank you.
I'm Tammy Holtman from AllAfrica.com. There's been some mention of states progressing towards democracy, but some of the growth has been in countries that have not been participatory at all and have no respect for human rights, et cetera. How do you see the issues of governance affecting the possibilities of eradicating poverty or of growth that some countries which are not democratic, how sustainable is that growth, especially in the current world environment?
Just behind.
Hi, Christina Kelly. I'm reading in one of these handy booklets in these packages. On page 30, it's talking about how there's a 3-year transition period to assist graduating countries to adjust the loss of benefits associated with being an LDC. Kind of reminds me of someone coming off of welfare unemployment in the U.S., which there's a lot of criticism of because people can stay in those programs pretty much indefinitely. So what is the motivation for a country to cross that threshold from maybe a high-performing LDC to a graduating country, especially when they might not have a full democracy fully accountable to their people?
My name is Roy Culpepper from the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. Just picking up on the issue of aid dependence, which has been brought up, is there not a lot more that both donor countries and the LDCs themselves can do to mobilize more domestic resources, both through the tax system and through their own internal financial markets? There are a number of initiatives that are already afoot among, for example, African countries. There's an African Tax Administrators Forum that was launched in Kampala just a year and a half ago. But there's also a lot of interesting discussions on how to reform the international tax rules, for example, to go beyond EITI, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, to going to a country-by-country reporting system so that multinational corporations would be much less able, through transfer pricing, to transfer profits away from developing countries and therefore reduce tax possibilities for those countries. And finally, global financial integrity here in Washington has documented the capital flight in the billions of dollars from the south to the north. Isn't there much more that developed countries, including the United States, that domicile the proceeds of this capital flight, isn't there much more that can be done to repatriate this capital flight to the countries of origin? We're talking about the Mubarak fortunes right now being repatriated to Egypt. Let's not stop there. Let's talk about the capital flight from all developing countries to developed countries. Thank you.
One more. Let's take one more question. Beth lady there. I think, yeah, just over there. Thanks. I think we have to close. We go up to 11, and we may not get all the responses, but so.
Hi, I'm Melinda St. Louis with Jubilee USA Network. I wanted to address the debt issue that you brought up, and particularly the impact that debt cancellation had on some of these countries. That perhaps some of the reason they were able to cope with the financial crises through stimulus is because their debt overhang had been eliminated through HPIC and MDRI, but very concerned about the 20 countries, LDCs, that are still in high debt distress, and particularly as lending increases by some of the emerging lenders that haven't participated in debt cancellation initiatives in the past, to just make the point that I think the LDC conference should think about how you deal with sovereign debt crises and particularly the need for a sovereign debt workout mechanism for countries in debt distress.
Thank you very much. We may not get all the responses, but we are going to ask the panelists to conclude with maybe 30 seconds. And I would also like to announce that there are some people who signed on for a strategy session after this, and that will be in the next building through the cafeteria, 1755, fourth floor. About 12 people who wanted to iron out some of the issues. 1755, fourth floor. So I'll start with Ambassador.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I would try to react to two questions mainly. One related to governance. To say that the current program of action that is ending next May, called the Brussels Program of Action, has governance as the second of its priority areas. And we are almost in agreement among all stakeholders in the process of negotiation, current negotiation, including the least developed countries themselves, that this should be one of the pillars of the next generation of commitment, because that's the only thing that the development partners are expecting the least developed countries to be performant on, to deliver on improving their governments, be it political, economic, corporate governance, environmental governance. So this will be part of one of the pillars, central pillars of the next generation of commitment coming from the LDCs. 3 years transition period. This is the process as it has been set up by the United Nations, and it is done in such a way that should be a smooth transfer from the status of least developed countries to a status of middle-income countries. And this smooth transition allows to consolidate the social gains obtained during the transition period and to make them irreversible. It means that the preference treatment accorded to a specific country graduating from the status of LDCs in terms of access of products in the basis of trade, access to financing, access to official development assistance, should be maintained during 3 years so that the country can smoothly go on to transfer. One last thing I would like to really put an emphasis on, that will be my closing statement, is that we need to put a particular emphasis on investment, productive investment, creating special regimes in current donor countries in order to incite the corporations to invest in productive sectors in the least developed countries. I think that will be the most sustainable trend, even more than the official development assistance. This is one, because it's a win-win situation. We also need to change our perception about the least developed countries. These are countries full of potential. The human resources is extra phenomenal. 70% of the population in LDCs are less than 30 years old. And these guys and girls are striving to really, their hunger for knowledge, their hunger for standards of living that prevailing everywhere around the world. So we can count on them to deliver once we empower them. So from an ever-assisted countries by the international community, we should see the LDCs as countries full of potential that we just need to unleash in order for the peoples to be empowered. So I will stop here, and thank you really for your attendance this morning.
Thank you very much. Very briefly, we have...
Okay, thank you very much. I just would like to touch upon the issue of domestic resource mobilization. In fact, I fully understand this issue, and this is very important for us. We have been discussing and debating this in and around the issue of the next generation of program of action. But we have to really understand the fact that LDCs, they have an issue of economic smallness and economic remoteness as well. And also, most LDC spend more money on debt servicing than they use for social safety net in their one country. So that they're, due to the size of economy, whatever we mobilize domestically is not really enough to face the development emergency and humanitarian crisis that these LDCs are facing. And the issue of governance, I just would like to conclude that this is something we have been raising very seriously to our government in LDC as well. We are advocating for pro-poor governance and also transparency and accountability, so that whatever resources available can be really reached out to poorest and most vulnerable communities in our countries.
Thank you. Steve?
Just briefly on 2 points, on Tammy's question around democracy. The patterns between development and democracy are changing quite rapidly at the moment. Since the end of the Cold War and the end of apartheid, we are seeing one of the great changes in the history of the world, and very few people notice it. We have never seen so many low-income countries become democracies in so short a time as we have in the last 15 years. It's never happened before. In fact, 20, 25 years ago, people would have said poor countries can't become democracies. The whole basis of modernization theory is that it really can't happen. And 20, 25 years ago, around the world, you would have looked at India, whose success was not so great, Botswana, which was doing much better, and Mauritius, and that's about it in terms of democracies. Since 1995, that's changed quite dramatically. And we have a very large number of fragile, imperfect, but emerging democracies among some of the poorest countries in the world. I think that bodes very well in the long run for much more accountable governance, much better investment of domestic resources, much better rule of law, and all that comes with that. 20 years ago, the idea would have been driven by Asia that to be successful in development, you had to be essentially an authoritarian government. In Africa, the record of authoritarian governments is really bad. The record of more democratic countries in the last 15 years is actually pretty good. So we're seeing a very different pattern in sub-Saharan Africa on this relationship between democracy and development than we saw historically in Asia. Now, the implication is your question, what about the countries that are non-democracies? Well, I'm more concerned. There are two types of non-democracies, if you will, that are showing some rapid growth. One are the oil exporters, and we all know the history of oil exporters. Looks good when oil prices are high, but doesn't always benefit people and can stop quickly. The others, there are some non-democracies that have done well, but none of them have really gone through a credible and peaceful transfer of political power. And until those countries do that, they are at more risk that those gains could be lost. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. Not that it can't happen, because we also know lots of non-democracies do well, but I think it's much more risky these days, and we'll have to wait and see for a credible transition of power. Just very quickly, Roy's questions about lots of things that countries can do domestically. Yes, 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 and yes, I think. There's lots of domestic resource flows.
I'll try and keep it short. Two points. Number one, this question about the relationship between governance, growth, and poverty, just picking up on what Steve was talking about. Let me just give you a slightly different perspective on it from some work we've been doing here. I think until a few, I'm going to approach this in terms of through the lens of fragility. I think until a few years ago, we used to think that there was a fairly linear path through which countries developed from fragility into stability and then into growth. And so you can imagine sort of low-income, fragile countries becoming stable low-income countries, then becoming stable middle-income countries. I think this whole idea is it's true for some countries. It happens. It happened in Liberia. I think it now represents a subset of countries. I think that we're seeing many new paths, and I don't really think we know what it means. I think the best example of this, the thing which really highlights this, is we now have two countries, Nigeria and Pakistan, who have just been lifted into middle-income country status, and they're incredibly fragile countries. They're very large countries, you know, large populations, still contain large numbers of poor. I think this is going to shine a light on this issue of kind of fragile middle-income countries. And the World Bank used to say that to be defined as fragile, you had to be low-income in the first place. I think this is now a dated idea. So I think this is it's going to causing me a headache. It should be causing everyone a headache thinking about these issues. Finally, a brief about the graduation issue, about the costs and benefits of graduation. It's a silly little story, but it's true. 5 years ago, I was living in Papua New Guinea when the government there received a letter from the UN saying that its development indicators had been declining and that Papua New Guinea was eligible to be considered for least developed country status. Now, this came at the wrong time for Papua New Guinea because just recently, just a few years before, the Australian foreign minister had implied that Papua New Guinea might be becoming a failing state, and this didn't go down very well in the country. They were very wary of foreign labels being imposed on them. And I know the chap who received this letter, as a senior bureaucrat, secretary of the Prime Minister's Department, took this letter with him to, I think, the Pacific Islands Forum, or perhaps it was the Melanesian Spearhead Group, one of these groupings of Pacific countries where senior bureaucrats get together to discuss things. And he brought along this letter, and he said to his peers, he said, you know, what am I to do? I received this letter. It's an affront to my people. You know, we are a society of subsistence, affluence. We don't take kindly to these kind of labels. And the chap from the Solomon Islands put up his hand and said, sir, I know exactly how you feel. I received a letter saying that we are ready to graduate to have least developed country status. We've just come out of a civil war. We're a small island stuck in the middle of the Pacific, miles away from anyone. How can the UN belittle our development challenges in this way? And I think the lesson from that is that it's a process which has to be managed. I actually think the UN does that very well by using its discretion and allowing countries to decide whether they're ready to graduate or not.
Thank you very much. And maybe we clap for the panel. This was a very lively and educative panel, and I hope that...